Tech Weekly is brought to you by Taylor Wessing, bringing you the latest on legal development in technology and media. For more information, head to guardian.co.uk/media-tech-law.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week we're sweeping up after the largest consumer electronics event in the Western world. If you've not seen the coverage on guardian.co.uk from the inimitable Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, or you can't be bothered to wade through the pages of announcements and predictions, keep listening for his review of the 2011 CES show. There will be reaction to the news that Microsoft Windows will run on ARM chips. He'll be talking to the British tablet manufacturer that's put Windows 7 on a tablet. He follows Sony as they plunge deep into 3D. He goes retro for the return of Asteroids. And he gets sci-fi with mind-controlled TV. Charles is literally flying back, so he can't join us in the studio today, but we do welcome Jemima Kish, our digital media correspondent, in his place, and of course, a fabulous person in her own right. Happy New Year, Jemima.
Hello. I don't think I'm posh enough to be a correspondent. I think you have to have been to Oxford or Cambridge to be a correspondent.
What would you prefer to
be? I'm a lowly reporter.
SVP.
Yeah, that's me.
Well, we're glad to have you back, and how was your New Year?
It's good. I have to say I'm slightly distracted by your apparel. You look like some kind of dejected, deposed Tibetan mountain king.
Jemima, I'm not well. You know, it's
I'm not
a matter
surprised
of
wearing an outfit like that, frankly.
I do regularly fashion fail, but this is purely and unadulteratedly for my own health.
Let's just say, listeners, she's dressed for comfort.
I'm dressed for warmth, thank you very much.
Okay.
But moving on, we'll also be looking not just at my fashion, but at the technology headlines and trends of the past week, including analysis of the fallout from the latest information injunction brought to Google and Twitter by the US government in the wake of the WikiLeaks scandals. Plus, we will be talking about the foundations that are being laid for wars in the mobile phone space, as Ofcom opens up 2G spectrum for data and video. Finally, Apple's new Mac App Store launches, but pirates are quick to circumvent the digital rights. All this and more from me and Jemima on this week's Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Let's start with this week's news. Apple launched their App Store for their Mac Snow Leopard operating system customers on Thursday, bringing the marketplace that their handheld and mobile device users have come to know to their desktop and laptop spaces. The virtual supermarket already has over 1,000 apps, from word processing and number crunching to games and support tools, and it aims to bring together all of the approved products Mac users could ever want, and of course, the exchange space to buy them in. Criticism was quick. Some people commented that the opaque approval process that's dogged independent developers and other app stores is in place on this service too. And the store is only available to customers who have the latest operating system installed on their machines. But more worryingly for the company were the announcements by several hacker groups that they'd already broken through the app store's security, potentially putting personal data information like credit card details at risk. Jemima, the hackers were pretty quick. They said they'd broken into the Mac App Store on the day it launched. What's happened since?
Well, there have been actually two things happened. One was a very kind of low-key hack, which involved copying a receipt from a free app into the file of a paid one that you'd downloaded. And that's just a fairly straightforward workaround. John Gruber, Daring Fireball, who we love, pointed out that's a very simple hack that people will always try out, and they should really be checking for that when they get apps into the App Store.
Well, what does that mean, that a receipt file is copied into somebody's personal store?
Well, if you're intimate enough with your Apple phone and you're motivated enough, shall we say, to try and investigate alternative ways of getting apps, then you'll probably be quite familiar with that as a technique, so it's quite well known. But it's also very easy for Apple to stop that, so it seems a bit strange that they're still allowing that to happen. The second hack was a little bit more complicated, and that's called Kickback. There's a group of hackers who say that they've already managed to circumvent the payment system on the Mac App Store, but they could just be bluffing because they haven't actually rolled it out yet. So what they're really doing is giving Apple the chance to patch a crack before it's even released.
How secure are our transactions now via the App Store?
Well, if you were really cautious, you could just completely delete your credit card details from iTunes and just use gift cards. That's, you know, for the truly paranoid. There are 160 million people, or rather there are the credit card details of 160 million people in the iTunes store that Apple is sitting on, and about 500 million users of iTunes overall. So that is a vast user base, and I think Apple is very well aware that they have the security of those people and their reputation very closely tied. That said, there have been some pretty major balls ups. In China, just last week, there was a story about Taobao, which is sort of the Chinese eBay, having the details of 50,000 iTunes users' credit cards available, which was pretty shocking, and Apple obviously said it was going to be looking into that. But there have been other cases as well. So it's not perfect. Apple is not perfect, despite what they like to think.
Now, Jemima, there have been people who've been predicting virtual marketplaces for years. But people have always said, no, no, we want to go into a shop, we want to buy a box, even if the box just has like a little piece of paper that has an activation code in it or something. But does the App Store really herald this shift from, you know, the kind of the shop consumer relationship where it's a physical entity to a virtual marketplace? Have we actually achieved the singularity?
I don't think it needs to be one thing or another. There will always be people that like to walk into a shop and buy a piece of software, and there will also be people who are buying very advanced, very complex software that, you know, requires just more stuff with it and perhaps needs to, they'll be spending a lot of money on it, and they need to feel that they're getting like a, you know, lots of glossy printed stuff with it as well. But we're talking about kind of building on the momentum and the popularity that the App Store and other app stores as well, but the Apple App Store has built on the phone and taking that to the mainstream. So people like my mum, who are only just getting to grips with how the kind of basic internet works, bless her, it's conceivable now that she would be able just to choose and download, say, you know, the BBC News app, something very, very simple, from the Mac App Store, because it's very easy to do. There is a note of caution here, though, which is about Apple taking control of your desktop. The worst case scenario would be that you could only download things through the App Store, and that means, of course, that all of that software would be subjected to Apple's fairly stringent approval terms. I've been looking through some of these today. I mean, obviously, they say things like no pornographic material, which does account for a fairly large proportion of internet activity, whatever Apple may choose to believe. But there are other things like software that is similar in look or function to Apple products won't be accepted. Anything that changes the native user interface, anything that installs shared components like browser plugins, everything with content or services that expire, anything that doesn't run on the current version of Mac OS, anything that's a beta version, anything with trademark, you know,
The concerns about the lists are valid. And I think as well, just very briefly, I think you mentioned as well that things like open source licenses aren't approved of.
Another one. Anything with copyleft licenses, which is a particular note of caution, I think.
Also in this week's news, the battle between freedom of information site WikiLeaks and the US government continues to rage, threatening international public diplomacy. The far-reaching case is now accessing accounts of people associated with the leaked documents across various social networking services. Julian Assange, for example, who's the founder of WikiLeaks, was furious last week when details of his Twitter account was called for by US officials. And this week, an Icelandic MP's Twitter details, including personal and public messages, have been demanded by the US. Jemima, what has happened? What is the story? Why on earth has 140 characters become something that's so important for the US government?
Well, the thing about 140 characters is they link up with other people sending 140 characters and form things called conversations, which when people are conspiring to reveal dark secrets from the American government becomes very significant. So Birgitta Jónsdóttir, it's my best Icelandic accent.
Well done.
Birgitta is the Icelandic MP, and she was the one that revealed that Twitter had been asked to hand over her information. Twitter received a subpoena from the Department of Justice in early December, and it was actually fairly detailed. It said that it wanted the internet protocol addresses, the email addresses, any phone numbers that were mentioned in direct messages or replies, and also all the correspondence between named people in that subpoena, which were Julian Assange and somebody that worked with him and this MP. So that's really worrying. And when I first heard about this story, my first thought was, I'm going to have to leave Twitter. If they hand these details over, I'm going to have to leave Twitter. But we subsequently found out that the subpoena contained a clause that said that Twitter was not allowed to reveal the existence of the subpoena, and they weren't allowed to tell the subjects mentioned in it either. They just had to hand over the data. Twitter, and good on them for doing this, contested that and successfully won. So that is how this MP and the other people mentioned in that subpoena now know about it. And Twitter also has told the world. So, yeah, good on them.
A couple of questions arise out of this. Twitter tweets are already stored in the U.S. Library of Congress. And so, you know, why couldn't the U.S. government just...
Do they store direct messages, though?
That I don't know about.
And they won't store the IP addresses or the contact details of people when they register or where they're accessing the service from. And I think those were key in this case, because the American government is obviously trying to build up a picture of the communication and collaboration with Bradley Manning, because that is the key to this case in working out what the liabilities are and who assisted him releasing that information.
Now, Bradley Manning is the cadet who released the cables,
yeah,
to WikiLeaks. It sounds an awful lot like a really interesting trend is that we are now using things like Facebook and Twitter to exchange what we would have traditionally exchanged via email, you know, say an email client. Would the U.S. government be able to come along to Mac Mail, which is the app that I use, and ask Mac to take all of my stuff? Or is it because it's on a U.S.-based server that they're able to have this injunction?
Well, actually, the Department of Justice have also gone to Google and Facebook, according to certain people involved in WikiLeaks, and they're putting pressure on Google and Facebook to reveal the details of these subpoenas. So I think the fact that we've heard about the Twitter one and we've heard about it in this detail is just the tip of the iceberg. And given how close a lot of these very big consumer technology companies are to the American government, don't forget, they're all based in Silicon Valley, which is the roots of the American defense industry. The ties are very, very close. We have no idea how much information they know about us. Probably all of it.
And what is, of course, fascinating is that we're expatriate. Oh, for myself, I'm an expatriate, and
An expatriate?
I know, it
Did you just
strange.
Disown your mother country?
What would I be called? I'm an expat. It's the same thing, isn't it? I didn't disown it. I'm still part of it, but I live elsewhere. Anyway, the point is that you have no ties to the U.S., yet your information, your details are being stored and being accessed by, or could potentially be accessed by, the U.S. government.
This is true, but I am using a service that is hosted within the U.S. Actually, there's another point going back to those Apple hacks that there have been lots of fake apps put into the App Store, and those apps have been developed by people based in Asia, I think, because they think they're out of reach of the long U.S. arm of the law.
So you kind of alluded to this in one of your comments, but how much power do companies have against authorities in keeping their users' details private? And really, I suppose the question is, it's almost a moral question. How much should they have in keeping their users' details private?
Well, fortunately, they have a lot of investment behind. When I say they, I mean Twitter, Facebook, obviously, and Google's enormous. They have enormous legal resources to defend themselves, and they really need an expert lawyer to work out how they defend themselves. And this is a fairly new area of law as well. On the consumer side, Dick Costolo, the Twitter chief executive, recently defended a Chinese woman who was imprisoned after sending a sarcastic tweet. She's actually been sent to a re-education camp, but he tweeted, "Dear Chinese government, year-long detentions for sending a sarcastic tweet are neither the way forward nor the future for your great people." And he did that very publicly. So he's clearly aware that people expect to see them defending the service and defending their users, because without them, they are nothing.
And of course, defending their ideology.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, finally, Ofcom has announced controversial plans to open up some of the mobile phone 2G spectrum, which is used for text and voice, to 3G, which is used for data and video services. Now, this move will free up the clogged airwaves as smartphones become commonplace. Hooray. But the decision has apparently angered mobile phone operator Three, whose spectrum license was awarded in 2000 and only for 3G bandwidth. The company is reportedly upset with Ofcom for giving other operators like Vodafone, O2, T-Mobile and Orange, whose licenses include a predominance of 2G bandwidth, an unfair proportion of future data and video services. So, Jemima, what has happened? Why are Three unhappy?
To give you the background, Ofcom say there's been an 81% increase in smartphone use, and there are now 12.8 million smartphone users. So there's a lot of pressure on the 3G network that we have, and a lot of interest from the mobile companies about how to expand this capacity because there is limited capacity. So they are looking at the 900 and 1800 megahertz spectrums, otherwise known as 2G, and expanding that out so that Vodafone, Orange, T-Mobile and O2 can benefit from that. So it would seem to be quite good. It would seem to be that a lot of customers would have better 3G services. It would mean that because these are slightly lower frequency, these signals could go further distances and would mean better signals inside buildings. For those of us inside very large concrete buildings, that seems to be good news when our signals drop all the time. So that's where we've got to. Now, in 2000, Ofcom auctioned the 3G spectrum. They have to auction these things because there is only limited capacity. There has to be somebody controlling this, which is what Ofcom does. They decided the best way to do that with 3G spectrum was to auction it off. So Three paid £4.4 billion for their chunk of 3G spectrum. The other operators paid a combined total of about £4.1 billion for their chunk. So Three made a significant investment in 3G as the kind of USP, if you like, for their network. So they are not a little bit grumpy about the prospect of a whole new chunk of spectrum being converted into 3G or allowed to be used for advanced kind of data services and things, because it undermines their proposition, and they are challenging Ofcom about that decision.
What responsibility does Ofcom have to create a balance, to rebalance the situation that they seem to be upsetting?
Well, they have to oversee distribution of these networks in a fair way, and they have to ensure that they don't give unfair preference, I suppose, to one. Operator, and because 3G's case, I suppose, is that they're going to say that they were sold this 3G spectrum under a bit of a false pretense if later down the line lots of other operators are going to be able to get into that same space.
Okay, well, given that, what's going to happen next?
Well, there is some speculation that 3 could be sold because this will undermine its market proposition substantially enough that, it's already the smallest operator and its most powerful feature at the moment, if you like, is that it is the most powerful operator in the 3G space. But it is likely that there will be a digital dividend auction at some point in the future where the government's going to sell off another round of spectrum for faster mobile networks. That will probably be before 2012. And Three are pretty keen to see an auction in that space, but only on a level playing field.
Well, that's it for this week's news. There is more on the site all week on these stories and, of course, the latest headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. Charles Arthur, the Guardian's technology editor, has been pounding the conference floor at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas for the past week, peering into panels, tinkering with tablets, and, well, shoving microphones in people's faces. He's scoured the halls for the trends in phones, consoles, and 3D TV. So here's Charles from the Nexus of the Future.
I'm here at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which vies with the mid-year IFA in Berlin for the title of the world's biggest consumer electronics show. Here at CES, it covers 1.5 million square feet. There's an estimated 2,500 exhibitors, of which 1,200 come from outside the US. There are 20,000 new products being announced, and the expectation is that by the time it closes at the end of Sunday, there'll have been a surge in visitors of around 10% compared to last year. As has been the case since 2009, the opening keynote was given by Microsoft's chief executive, Steve Ballmer. Has to be said, it did leave people a bit underwhelmed. Some began filing off to the exits before he had finished. It did seem pretty tame stuff. There were no flying cars or robot butlers. Instead, he told us how well Kinect for Xbox had done. He touted Windows Phone 7, and they showed off a new, better version of Microsoft's table-sized Surface. The touchscreen, where now it's only 4 inches thick, and every pixel has its own camera. But Steve Ballmer did announce something which does have wide-ranging ramifications. The next version of Windows will be able to run not just on chips built by Intel with its x86 architecture, but also on chips built on ARM architecture.
Earlier today, we announced that the next version of Windows will support systems on a chip architectures from Intel, from AMD, and from ARM. This announcement is really all about enabling a new class of hardware and new silicon partners for Windows to bring the widest possible range of form factors to the market. We made the announcement now in order to allow all of our partners to work together and build upon this innovation. Windows has always been and will continue to be about the breadth of hardware and software applications and innovation. NVIDIA, Qualcomm, and Texas Instruments are working on SoC designs based on the ARM architecture. Intel and AMD will continue to innovate on the x86 platform, including the new low-powered SoC systems that will be fully supported by Windows and will include support for native x86 applications.
ARM, which stands for Advanced RISC Machines, is a British company which licenses its low-power chip cores to scores of companies around the world, including Apple and NVIDIA, whose Tegra 2 chip has wowed people here. It's got incredible graphics processing capability, and they're building a CPU as well. The problem for Microsoft has been that Intel's Atom chips for its low-power systems just can't compete for their energy usage with ARM's. That means it's hard to get them into tablets. I asked Ujesh Desai, Vice President of Product Marketing at NVIDIA, how important he thought Microsoft's announcement was.
Frankly, Microsoft's announcement is a game changer. ARM is just taking off like crazy, right? And if you look at the developers, because of what Apple has done with iOS and Google has done with Android, you know, the developers and the applications are already there on ARM. You know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of applications. So by Microsoft taking Windows and now making that available on ARM, that's going to make it even explode and have growth be, you know, exponentially that much bigger.
By the time that the next version of Windows comes along, do you think that it will be feasible to virtualize the old x86 code so that that'll just be able to be virtualized and run on the ARM chip? Or do you think that third-party writers will have to recompile or rewrite their apps?
You know what? You know, it's probably a question better served to Microsoft, but I think you probably see a little bit of both, where you'll have guys doing the recompile and other guys being able to, you know, take it and bring it over.
Now, as we did expect, there were plenty of tablets. Something like 80 were released or shown off, including dozens running Google's Android operating system, notably one from Motorola running Honeycomb, the 3.0 version of Android. But there were only a handful, if that, of Windows-based tablets, after all the expectation of last year. And then there were the outliers. First, Hewlett-Packard has put off its tablet release until February. That's going to be running the WebOS operating system, which it got from Palm, which it bought for $1 billion last year. And then there's RIM, maker of the BlackBerry, which has teased about its 7-inch playbook since late last year. I did find one company offering a Windows tablet, a British company which makes the iTablet, from, of all places, Evesham. I spoke to its founder and chief executive, Francis Davis, and asked him how the show was going.
Oh, phenomenal. 300 inquiries from distribution and retail partners, both in America, Europe. It's been absolutely fantastic.
How does the interest break down between the Windows tablet and the Android tablet?
I think predominantly Windows. The Android, there's lots and lots of Android tablets here at the show, but I'm not aware of any other Windows tablets here at CES. There might be, I just don't know about them yet.
And what do you think are the prospects for the whole tablet business?
I read a report from Gartner in November where they forecast 55 million unit sales in 2011. which is a big number, a huge number. If I get 1% of that, I'll be very, very pleased, which is 500,000 units. So, but, you know, we've just entered the marketplace. We're 8 days since we launched the product. I think it's going to be huge this year.
The next big trend has been smart TV, which feels very like the rebranding of Google's TV effort launched last year. The idea is that your TV will connect to the internet, or you'll be able to browse files on your home network, assuming you have one. And it will offer Android-style apps that will connect to TV services, such as, in the US, Hulu or Netflix. What I couldn't work out was how well this will work in the UK, where the iPlayer, for example, is very specific about what sort of devices it will and won't play on, and in Europe, where there are all sorts of TV catch-up services. It would certainly be nice to have iPlayer on your TV, but I wonder if that isn't what Sky Plus, Virgin's V Plus, and all the Freeview recorders are trying to do. 3D TV is also here in a big way, but the problem is that it still needs special glasses, which means you have to buy an extra pair if you have friends around. And also, that for people who've just splashed out on an HD set, you have to get rid of that and get a new one. But Sony, which is one of the biggest makers of TVs in the world, is pushing 3D really hard. It thinks that it'll be popular both for consuming and for watching content. First, Sony had a flip-style camera, which has two lenses for taking 3D films.
It'll shoot 1920 by 1080, full high-definition 3D video. It has a 2.4-inch LCD that you can view your 3D videos on without using glasses. It'll also take 5-megapixel still images as well. It has auto macro and a 4x digital zoom. And as you can see, it takes great 3D. It has HDMI out, so if you want to plug it into your 3D television, you can do so and put on your glasses right here and watch 3D at home, or you can put it on the web like YouTube or Facebook or one of the video sharing sites and watch your 3D there as well.
Then it showed off a VAIO PC, which has a 3D screen, though you will need the glasses again.
Obviously, you could use it for content like Blu-ray or any sort of 3D content that you would want to watch on it. You can see we have a gaming demo on here. But also, you can do photography, you can do home videos, any of those sorts of things. A lot of pieces are out there now to capture that kind of content. This gives you the ability to view it virtually anywhere. If you can see right here, there's a 3D button. That's actually live upconverting. So this will actually upconvert 2D to 3D on the fly while you're watching. So let's say you put a Blu-ray movie in there that is only in 2D. Push that button, it will upconvert it to 3D and still maintain 1080p picture quality. We are the world's first to be able to do that, to upconvert and maintain true HD. This computer is going to be starting at $1,699 and be available in just a few weeks.
Now, one of the biggest names in consumer electronics isn't here, Apple. But his influence is everywhere, and hundreds of stands selling iPhone and iPad accessories. There's an entire section of Chinese manufacturers, almost all hailing from Shenzhen, who seem to be playing variations on the theme of iPhone 4 or iPad cases. There's even a thriving business making prop iPads, because having the real thing would be too expensive. So they just have the iPod shell, with a picture of the home screen on the front. And there are hundreds of them. Among the most fun products was the iCade from Ion Audio, which started as an April Fool's joke, but turned into a real product. You slot your iPad into the mini arcade, and it has the buttons that let you play Asteroids, the real old Atari Asteroids. Adam Cohen of Ion showed it to us.
We're going to go ahead and open the Asteroids game, which we've worked with Atari to make available to work with iCade, which is the product we're showing here. Go ahead and pop it in, and now we've got classic arcade control of a classic arcade game with joystick and buttons just like you remember it from the arcade you played in the 80s. Same game, just as you remember. And we're working with Atari to incorporate this functionality into dozens of classic arcade games to give you the same experience that you had with a slushy on the side playing video games in the 80s. We're expecting it out in the spring, and it has a target retail of $99 for the console. You bring your iPad, we bring the game controls.
That was Adam Cohen of Ion. Now, though Steve Ballmer didn't show off or even promise flying robot cars in his keynote, I did find one company which has a technology that sounds so futuristic, I think we'd all like it. That's Interaxon. I'll let its founder, Ariel Garten, explain what they were showing.
So we're demonstrating two things. One is a thought-controlled 3D environment, and the other is a thought-controlled version of Zenbound, the famous iPad game.
How does it work?
So it works using a simple sensor that touches your forehead, and it reads your brain waves. So when you enter different brain states, you have different thoughts, you have particular patterns of brainwave that we can identify and use those as a control signal.
So will we be able to use those in the near future, perhaps, to change the channel on our TV as well as watching 3D TV?
In the midterm future, you'll be able to use it to change the channel. In the immediate future, you'll be able to use it to engage in the 3D world on the television, or in any world on the television, and navigate through it and have it understand parts of you because it's connected directly to your mind.
Where did you get the idea, and you know, where's the technology come from? Did you think of the thought control first, or what?
So the technology originally comes out of a lab in Toronto of Dr. Steve Mann. He's the accredited inventor of the wearable computer. Some know him as the world's first real cyborg. Most people even now don't realize that it's real and it's here and it's possible.
And how much would it cost, roughly?
About $150.
That was Ariel Garten from Interaxon. I'm Charles Arthur from the floor of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. It's been an amazing week. You can read all our coverage at guardian.co.uk/technology and look for the CES 2011 tag. Now, back to the studio.
Thank you, Charles. Jemima, that's quite a lot of stuff that Charles saw.
Holy bejesus. Well, rather him than me, if I'm completely honest.
I think the man needs at least a week off after that.
It's just working out where to start with something like that. The scale of that place is so intimidating.
And of course, you're getting pitched everything constantly. You're just being barraged by iPad cases and 3D TV being chucked at you.
And all those stalls that use ladies in bikinis that obviously not, well, always guaranteed to never get any press from me.
You've never been to E3, have you?
No.
That's the game show. You want to see girls in bikinis? Go to E3.
No.
Anyway, moving on. Well, that's all for this week. Thanks to Jemima and Charles. Next week, we're in India for the first of our reports on how technology is transforming the world. Get in touch via Facebook or Twitter. All the links are on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. I'm Alex Krotowski, and yes, I may look like Nanak of the North. Thank you very much for that, Jemima. Next week, our regularly scheduled programming will see me in normal clothing.
You look like a cross between Mork and Mindy. It's brilliant.
I approve of that. Thank you very much. The producer this week was Scott Collie. Thank you very much for listening. I'm not sitting upside down though. Nanu, nanu. Awesome, I'm gonna watch that again.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.